Good evening, everybody. It's nice to see you here in my humbly abode. I am enjoying this wonderful Father's Day. I got a lot of interesting things to talk to you about. And this is the Gingerbread Band, by the way, as I stutter over my intro, as is common, as is normal. So, as I just mentioned, today is Father's Day. Big shaboop. I always feel it's kind of anticlimactic compared to Mother's Day. Not to complain. But I would like to go over just a couple interesting facts about the holiday itself. And then after that, we're going to get into some Norse mythology and maybe just a little bit of Taoist reading. We'll see. So, Father's Day began in the United States by a woman named Sonora Dodd, and she was trying to celebrate her father, who had raised six children on his own, and it was first celebrated in a YMCA in Spokane, Washington, in the year 1909. It was officially instated as a national holiday in 1966 by Lyndon B. Johnson. And it had kind of like a rough go. It was picked up by quite a few people as soon as people started to realize it. But it lost a lot of popularity in the 1920s when Sonora went and stopped promoting it herself, which it lost a little bit of leverage and a little bit of momentum getting national coverage. And it was always kind of a niche project anyways. And so it's generally done on the third Sunday of June, which kind of switches around a little bit. It could be the 15th, the 16th, the 17th. This year it is the 20th of June, 2021. And so it was pretty obscure, and a lot of people actually doubted it for commercial value. A lot of people tried to say that they thought that people were just trying to make another holiday for some reason so we could sell more shit. And so a lot of people were like, they called it the second Christmas for men's products, which I don't know. I work in the cooking industry. It might be different with like people who sell knives and hunting gear or do, you know, I don't know what traditional dad shit is. Tools. My dad likes tools. He's a man's man. I don't know. But like being a cook, you know, Mother's Day is like the day of all days. Like that's when everything is getting fucked up on a kitchen line, you know, like everybody and their mother brings their mom to a restaurant for Mother's Day. And you know, Father's Day you don't even see a big tiff. And I guess like doing a little bit of research, a lot of other people do take their fathers to meals in other countries. So just like here's a little bit of a data just for shits and giggles. In Catholic Europe, Father's Day, in a way, has been celebrated on St. Joseph's Day, which is March 19th, and that goes all the way back to the year 1508, which is actually pretty incredible. That's over 500 years ago, 513 years, 14 years. I'm not a mathematician. So they've been doing it for a really long time on that day, and then it's almost like universal across the country, across the countries in the world. So it's called a version of father recognition is called Bhadrapada Amavasya in Nepal. And then it's done on the first Sunday in Australia and Fiji and New Zealand and Papua New Guinea. And it's done on May 8th. It's called Parents' Day in South Korea. And it's called Family Day in Israel, which is also part of Shavuot. It's not a national holiday in China. However, a lot of people will do it kind of underneath the books following Western traditions. And a lot of other countries that don't really have national things, like the Western world has a lot of strength and a lot of oomph when it comes to influencing trends and culture. You know, like Coca-Cola's fucking everywhere. The clothing styles, you know, like you look at tribal people who are found in like the middle of South America, and they might have been found 5 years ago, and you look at them now, they got blue jeans and basketball jerseys, and it's kind of nuts, you know, like thinking about how quickly a culture from one place can really, really kind of have a big influence on other places. I find that intriguing, you know, just a little bit. But yeah, so that's my Father's Day shtick. And now we're going to get really into the meat of it all. Today, since it's Father's Day, I thought we'd get into Norse mythology. So I'm going to call it All Father's Day, just to be a little bit cheesy. So Norse mythology has a very rich history. It's not as old as I consider a lot of other sort of mythologies and ideologies and religious use of ways to conceptualize the world and make sense of things. And it doesn't have to always just be like religion. It doesn't have to be gods or deities. Science, in a way, is a force that is used to describe the world and make sense of things to give people comfort through that. So a lot of the myths that build and form what is considered Norse paganism comes from North Germanic peoples. And these peoples went through Norway. I mean, there's just this massive groups of tribes of people who were kind of loosely held together. They're very barbaric. You know, when you think of civilization in China and you think of civilization in Persia, you know, these are massive groups of people held together by strong ideology, currency, faith, whatever way you want to figure that bind and think about that glue that holds these people together. The glue that holds together groups of tribes, you know, consider the Ghouls. The Ghouls, which is probably these predecessors of a lot of these people that turned into these North Germanic peoples. And I'm sure actually there's probably a connection, even though I don't have anything on it, so don't quote me. But the Ghouls were millions of people, but they were all independent tribal cultures that all had their own kingship, not kings, leaders. But when they went up against Rome, they kicked Rome's ass. Because, you know, I don't remember which Roman it was, but Rome went up into Europe and was trying to expand territory. And they just got their asses kicked by these Ghouls because they were just big, tall, 6 foot tall people that were just hard fighting warriors. And even though they didn't have a lot of glue holding them together, there was just so many of them in this not quite patriotism, but you know, when you have an interdependence that's not as abstract, that's not, I'm an American, so my dependence is to my nation. Whereas the amount of dependence I have on my family, on the people I work with, those are strong ties. And if you have a community of people that depend on each other to survive, to eat, that sort of stuff holds people together so much more than abstract ideas like money or or any sort of politics. So anyways, these Germanic people are this kind of tribal sort of people. And a lot of what we have written down of Norse mythology comes from this guy named Saemund and this other guy named Snorri Snergensen. I think I actually had a little bit on this in a different podcast or one that will come. And most of that stuff got written down in the mid-1200s, I think. Late 1100s to the early to mid-1200s. But a lot of this spoken stuff, a lot of the root myths for a lot of these stories comes from the mid-11th century, which is the 1000s, you know, and probably a little bit before. But there's a lot of paganist roots that go back hundreds of years. But the thing about it is a lot of these tribal cultures could have had different variants of gods per different area. So different places would have maybe slight different distinctions. Like you have Juno and Zeus with Rome and Germany and how they kind of, or not Rome and Germany, Rome and Greece. Sorry, major faux pas there. But with how they kind of change names, but the gods could kind of mingle. But, you know, so these the strict stories that are written down is probably this amalgamation of a lot of tales that were told by mouth, which is just really cool. A lot of modern day Norse comebacks with people who are trying to do it, they call it heathenism. And then there's this is called Asatru. Yeah, heathenry. And Asatru, which means loyalty to the gods. And it's modern day practice. There's a lot of Christian influence over this Norse paganism in that crucial time period when things were starting to get written down, is when there's this massive flux of Christianity coming in. And I know I mentioned this, but as this flux came in, they brought with them culture, and then they also brought with them written language to a lot of these areas, which is what allowed these things to be written down. So continental Germanic tribes were called the Teutons, and you know, a lot of these gods that you think of, like Thor, is called, I think, Danor in Teuton. So there's a lot of transference of culture and a lot of transference of these ideas. And then the Scandinavian and the Gothic cultures of these Germanic tribes were the Norse. And what happened is that this king got taken over in Norway, and a lot of people jumped ship and left to Iceland, which is where you hear about the Vikings and all that. And it was kind of like this utopian place where they just hopped on their ships, got away from continental Europe. There's a lot of fighting. You know, there's huge places in France and the UK and Germany and just these huge places, and they kind of just put a lot of water between them so they could have their own little nation. So a lot of the recorded sagas and the lore were confusing because of how they mixed in these Christian ideas. And so a lot of the lore that you read in the Edda, there's the mythological Edda, and then there's the heroic Edda. And a lot of the morals you start to see pop up are very similar. You know, I'm of the firm belief that a lot of these ideas kind of are cycled around, and you see the root in a lot of, in any place you look, in any idea, whether it's, you know, big gods, small shamanism, you start to see similar ideas. And like those root ideas, I hate to say they're inherent, but moralistic in the way that we have ideals that we at least seem to share. And I say seem very vaguely. So in the new sort of use of modern heathenry in Asatru, there's actually kind of a pseudo-racism where a lot of these groups will only allow strict bloodlines into the churches, or not, I don't know if they call them churches, whatever they call them. But it's kind of strange how you start to see that grouping show up where people aren't really allowed to, they have to be, you know, this tiny population of people to even be allowed to come in. So there's two different types of big mainstream modern Norseism. And that comes across as Odinism and Theodinism, which I don't really have too much stuff on. Whereas Odinism is more to do with, you know, Odin worship, and Theodism. And somebody, if anybody has more information, please feel free to contact me and tell me more. But the Theodism has more to do with like the theodicy behind it. So in real basic, the introductory myth in Norse is basically there's this giant that shows up. Okay, so in the beginning of the world, there's the ice world, which is Niflheim, and then there's the fire world, which is Muselheim. And Muselheim is north of Niflheim. And so Niflheim has this ice, and what's happening is the fire is actually starting to melt the ice, so it starts to precipitate, but then it freezes, so it makes a stalactite. And then as it melts back down inside one of these stalactites of ice, of condensation, between the interaction of Niflheim and Muselheim, comes this giant named Ymir. And so Ymir, he starts to sweat because he gets hot. And so out of his sweat comes two other giants, which I don't have their names written down. So Amir eventually ends up dying. And after he dies, his blood becomes the ocean, and his bones become the earth, and then all the different worlds, basically, because there's 9 worlds that are part of this system, and each of the worlds are called Himes. So everybody knows about the big old ash tree, which is Yggdrasil. I'm still kind of confused on the interactions between Yggdrasil and Ymir. You know, it's very convoluted, and I'd love to sit down with somebody who's actually really versed on this, who could seriously show me what and how to understand a lot of these things. It is pretty weird. So Yggdrasil is the connection that is happening between all these places. Midgard is described as being around the eyebrows of Ymir. What's like the eyebrows, if you kind of think about them, that they're like almost like a wall, almost like a ridge in a way. And so connecting Midgard and the gods world is Bifrost, which is the rainbow bridge that everybody's probably familiar with from the movies with Thor, the pretty old bridge. So basically at this point, we have Jotunheim, which is the land of the giants. So the frost giants come out of Ymir, and then they're the ones that are in power at first. So kind of like if you think about Zeus and the big giants, you know, there's always like the gods, but then there's the gods, which is kind of weird. Like, and what, how many rings do you go through that sort of Koopy doll before you reach the gods of the gods of the gods of the gods? And maybe we're gods to something else on that concept. But it's kind of weird. So the gods end up, you know, creating, I don't know, like, so mankind end up being created to populate Midgard. At this point, Odin's in control. Odin's had children. Loki is come about. Loki is the combination of an Eton and a giant. So he's part frost giant. And so he's the mischievous one. And his bloodline may have something to do with that in some way, shape, or form. But so Loki ends up, one of the really cool stories, he ends up killing Baldur. So Baldur is like one of the prized, he's described as the most beautiful god. He's the god of poetry. And at this point, his mother has basically put this shield of a spell on him where no material can harm him on the planet. No steel, no stone. So the only thing that can harm him ends up being this thing that's called mistletoe. So for some reason, all the gods are jackasses. So they make up this game where they chuck shit at Baldur because he can't die. So they just start throwing things at him, shooting things at him. Like, oh, here's the pretty god, and he can't die. So let's just throw things at him. So it's kind of like an Achilles story. So Loki gets wind of his weakness and what to do. And so he ends up fashioning an arrow made out of mistletoe. And he dares, I think it's Hod, who is Baldur's brother, to shoot him with this arrow. And he shoots him, and the mistletoe pierces him, and he dies. So the death of Baldur is, like, super mischievous, and it's Loki's fault. And so this just superiorly pisses everybody off. And so this is when there's, like, you know, Loki ends up in deep water. And there's all kinds of other stories and myths about it. But, yeah, there's this rich mythology. Just very rich. So Odin only drinks wine. He has 2 ravens on either shoulder that explore the world and come back and whisper to him secrets. Odin commits suicide in order to gain ultimate power, basically. So he hangs himself upon Yggdrasil. And he hangs himself there for 9 days, and he makes all the other gods promise not to give him any food or water. So he ends up dying on the tree, but he resurrects himself through his power. So he almost has a Jesus moment in a way. And this is how he gets this power. And then another way is he gets the ability to speak poetry from this giant. I think his name is Gershel. Don't quote me. I don't have it written down. So Odin ends up going over there, and he ends up seducing the daughter of this giant. Ends up fucking the giantess, you know, just kind of being like a man slut, kind of like Zeus, you know, like all these connections to a lot of these gods and introductory myths. So the daughter of the giant ends up helping him steal this mead, the special mead that gives him this like silver tongue that lets him spit beautiful poetry. And then as soon as he gets it, he runs out and just leaves the daughter there and is like, oh, I'm out. And so I think the giant actually ends up killing the daughter, which is just really crazy. So there's two wolves that pull the sun and the moon around the earthly plane. And they're basically constantly trying to like, just they pull them on these chariots, kind of. Like, I kind of think it like a chariot or like a dog sled. Yeah, kind of like a dog sled. But then the sun and the moon is on the chariot being pulled around. And so on Yggdrasil is this nasty ass squirrel. And then there is, I think it's a wolf and then the Midgard serpent, who are just real nasty creatures. And then they're constantly talking shit to each other. And the squirrel ends up ferrying their words back and forth to each other so that they fight. And so in the end, the gods end up facing Ragnarok, which is basically the end of worlds. And within the end of worlds, there's Thimblewinter, which is when everything gets cold. And then the Midgard serpent, they go up and they eat the wolves and they end up eating the sun and the moon. But out of Ragnarok, a new world is always born. So it's kind of like this cyclical sort of thing. Oh, yeah. And then I wanted to mention something I kind of forgot. But back with Ymir, when Ymir kind of sweats himself out of the icicle that formed between Muspelheim and Niflheim, there also ended up being this sacred cow called a Dumbla, which I love that name, a Dumbla. A Dumbla. A Dumbla. So that's what Ymir eats before he ends up having more worlds, or that he ends up dying and creating the worlds, I guess. It's kind of crazy. So, yeah, that's my shtick on a little bit, very basic from a novice. I don't have anywhere near enough time on this material. So if you want to correct me, please feel free. Educate me, please. I will always accept that. It's crucial that people come argue with me and correct me when I'm wrong, because a lot of the time I find this interesting and I want to share it with you. And if any of this interests you, go look into it. Prove me wrong, and we'll come together and we'll have more information at the end of this. I just think it's a very rich mythology, and it's hard. You consider the Icelanders and the Vikings and the way that they live their lives. These are hard lives, and they're hard stories to back up these hard lives. So yeah, let's go into this, and I'd like to read a couple things from Havamal. Well, maybe we'll read a couple things. So we'll start out with Voluspo. I just wanted you to get an idea of how these writings kind of sound. So in Voluspo, Odin's talking, he summoned this giantess who witnessed the beginning of the world, and she's basically telling him of the story of how time started. So this is verse 23 of Voluspo. On the host his spear did Odin hurl, then in the world did war first come. The wall that girdled the gods was broken, and the field by the warlike Wanes was trodden. The Wanes are the ones who they end up getting in a war with at the end. It's who they're fighting in Ragnarok. And I think they're from like another world almost. Then sought the gods their assembly seats, the holy ones the council held, whether the gods should tribute give or to be alike should worship belong. Then sought the gods their assembly seats, the holy ones in council held, to find who with venom the air had filled, or had given Ode's bride to the giant's brood. In swelling rage, then rose up Thor. Seldom he sits when he such things hears. And the oaths were broken, the words and bonds, the mighty pledges between them made. I know of the horn of Heimdall, hidden under the high-reaching holy tree. On it there pours from Valfather's pledge a mighty stream. Would you know yet more? So Thor, as he's mentioned, is a badass. And in a lot of these Germanic religions, or Germanic peoples who are taking this sort of breed of religion, this Norse, Scandinavian, Germanic, paganist sort of ideology, a lot of them are actually Thor worshippers, and Thor actually supplants Odin as being permanent among the gods, which is very interesting when you consider it. And so Thor is considered the most barbarian. He doesn't care about rules. He'll do whatever he wants. And he's kind of, you know, the blonde hair. Everybody's kind of gets him in the Marvel movies now. And so we have that idea of who Thor is, you know, and that's kind of a good representation because he was the alpha male kind of person to look up to in a lot of these. And so, and then Heimdall is the god who guards Bifrost. So he's considered the gatekeeper between worlds, between the godly world and Midgard, which is the land of man. So that's pretty cool. So yeah, here's a little excerpt or a little footnote. Thor, the thunder god, son of Odin and Jorth, Earth, particularly Harbrothskloth and Thipsvigpasim. Yeah, don't. These are hard words. Oaths, etc. The gods, by violating their oaths to the giants who rebuild Asgard, aroused the undying hatred of the giant race, and thus the giants were among their enemies in the final battle. So when they're fighting the Wanes, the giants come in to fuck shit up too. You know, it's just part of it. You know, so hard entry myth. So Havamal is kind of like the words of Odin. And it reads kind of like, almost like he's giving advice. Like he's speaking down and it's like, here's like almost like the commandments when God spoke to Moses in the Judaic books. You know, this is kind of like Odin sitting down with men. And I don't know who he's speaking to, but he's giving out commandments. And I really like it. So here's a couple. Fire he needs, who with frozen knees has come from the cold without. Food and clothes must the farer have, the man from the mountains come. Water and towels and welcoming speech should he find who comes to the feast. If renown he would get, then again he greeted, wisely and well must he act. Wits must he have, who wanders wide, but all is easy at home. At the witless man the wise shall wink, when among such men he sits. A man shall not boast of his keenness of mind, but keeps it close in his breast. To the silent and wise does ill come seldom when he goes as a guest to a house. The knowing guest who goes to the feast in silent attention sits, with his ears he hears, with his eyes he watches, thus wary are wise men all. So I really like that. And it's kind of like how you comport yourself when you're on the move, like when you're a guest in people's houses, when you're wise, like how the difference between a wise man and an ignoramus. And how the wise, when they're in an uncomfortable situation, when they're sitting around people, you don't want to boast and give out your hand. You don't want to, if you don't know who your friends are and who your enemies are, and if you're just, there's often this sentiment to show off when we're around people we do not know, and especially when we're, even if we don't know we're afraid, but if we feel fear, like, oh, here's my balls, you know, like, let me show you how much of a badass I am. Like that old joke with what's his face, where he's like, every kid needs to get into a fight, because if you don't know if you're Billy Badass, you know, you think you're Billy Badass, then you meet Billy Badass, he beats your ass, and then you know, like, if you didn't ever get into a fight, you wouldn't know. So it's kind of like, you don't want, I don't know, that's not a great analogy, but if you're out, you don't want to talk shit before you know who your friends or enemies are, you know? A better burden may no man bear, for wanderings wide them wisdom. It is better than wealth on unknown ways, and in grief a refuge it gives. A better burden may no man bear, from wandering wide than wisdom. Worse food for the journey he brings not a field than an over-drinking of ale. Less good there lies than most believe in ale for mortal men. For the more he drinks, the less does man of his mind the mastery hold. Over beer the bird of forgetfulness broods and steals the minds of men. With the heron's feathers fettered I lay, and in Gunnlod's house withheld. Drunk I was dead drunk when the Fjallger wise I was. 'Tis the best of drinking if back one brings his wisdom with him home. The son of a kingdom shall be silent and wise, and bold in battle as well. Bravely and gladly a man shall go till the day of his death has come. So that's a commentary on drinking, which, consider this time when beer is safer than water. Drinking's a big deal. So imagine having to drink enough beer to actually stay hydrated, but trying to keep your wits and keeping that self-control. And when you start to drink, you want to drink more. You know, that's a tendency with these addictive substances. And he's talking about the bird of forgetfulness, and how when we drink, we forget our inhibitions, we forget our intentions, And he's like, the wise drinker still has his wisdom when he gets back home. So when you get home, you're able to control your shit and keep your head straight. Which I liked that. Friends shall gladden each other with arms and garments, as each for himself can see. Gift givers' friendships are longest found, if fair their fates may be. To his friends a man a friend shall prove, and gifts with gifts requite. But men shall mocking with mockery answer, and fraud with falsehood meet. To his friend a man a friend shall prove, to him and the friend of his friend. But never a man shall friendship make with one of his foeman's friends. If a friend thou hast whom thou fully wilt trust, and good from him wouldst get, thy thoughts with his mingle, and gifts shalt thou make, and fare to find him oft. If another thou hast whom thou hardly wilt trust, yet good with him wouldst get, thou shalt speak him fair, but falsely think, and fraud with falsehood requite. So it's talking about being careful when making friends, and the friends and the people you surround yourself. I think I heard somebody say we are the five closest people that we are around. We pick up the habitudes of the people who we encounter and who we are with. A measure of wisdom each man shall have, but never too much let him know. The fairest lives do these men live, whose wisdom wide has grown. A measure of wisdom each man shall have, but never too much let him know. For the wise man's heart is seldom happy, if wisdom too great he has won. A measure of wisdom each man shall have, but never too much let him know. Let no man the fate before him see, for so he is freest from sorrow. So having wisdom, but the middle ground of ignorance, because ignorance is bliss. And if we know too much, you know, say you're in a relationship and somebody's cheating on you. You know, the ignorance is bliss. They could be cheating on you and you could still love the shit out of them. And while they're cheating on you, you still have that compassion. And as soon as you know that they've done it, it's like all of that falls apart and all that breaks, and the knowledge of what is actually going to happen. Not saying that you should stay ignorant. I would always fair to say that you should become uncomfortable and to push yourself into uncomfortability, because that wisdom is far more valuable than to sustain ignorance for comfort, if that makes any sense. But it's to be careful. And to be careful what wisdom you approach yourself with, because some things might appear as wisdom, but they're not. And you might read something that hurts you or expose yourself to something that hurts you. All right, let's do one more from Havamal, and I'm going to give this one a quit. I really like these ones. Havamal is definitely my favorite. In a breaking bow or a burning flame, a ravening wolf or a croaking raven, in a grunting boar, a tree with roots broken, in billowy seas or a bubbling kettle, in a flying arrow or falling waters, in ice new formed or the serpent's folds, in a bride's bed speech or a broken sword, in the sport of bears or in sons of kings, in a calf half that is sick or a stubborn thrall, a flattering witch or a foe new slain, in a brother slayer if thou meet him abroad, in a half-burned house, in a horse full swift, one leg is hurt and the horse is useless. None had ever such faith as to trust in them all. We can have intentions to do things and to set things out and to try our best. But to expect everything to work out is asinine and silly. We can let the arrow fly and we can aim our best and we can put our best try out. And this kind of goes back to some things I was reading from the Bhagavad, which is this attachment to fruitive action. It's that we need to work. We need to always work. But in the Bhagavad, they have this thing called Krishna consciousness, which you work in devotion to the Lord, which is Bhagavan, which is the Godhead, whereas Krishna is the ultimate personality. So we technically all have a piece of Krishna within ourselves as para-atman, which is the seat of the higher soul within ourselves, which is the piece of the Bhagavan that's within every living being. And basically how we need to work, and doing our work the best is doing it devotionally in service to this Lord. But being attached to the end results is one way to begin suffering, because if we're attached to how we do it, we do our best devotionally with love, but we don't wait to see if how it turned out, because it doesn't matter our attachment to the end goal all that really matters is that we're working hard and we do our best in that moment, is the idea behind the fruit of action. And this is kind of what I see with the arrow. When you're shooting the arrow, we try our best. I'm aiming for that shot and I'm going to do my best, do the best I can. But I can't trust in that arrow to behave perfectly because of the chaos of the world, I think, would be the root of what that is saying. It's very weird when you consider how much effort we put out in this world. And I think effort is so beautiful. Everybody needs to have effort. Everybody needs to have something that they are creating. Everyone needs to have words that they can say that they're passionate about and people that they want to share their passions with. Because being able to go up to somebody and saying, this is what I find beautiful, this is what I find cool, you know, that's such a powerful thing. And when you find somebody that shares your interests and that thinks that what you think is cool too, and you can come together and make cooler things in the synthesis of coolness by combining ideas and speaking and having conversations, that is such an amazing thing. And I think it's just so cool. And there needs to be more of it. There needs to be more people having discussions. I want to start conversations. That's why one of my favorite things is the question mark. And in being able to use a question mark, often people have this implication where I feel like when you ask a question, people want to give you the answer they think you want. And often I'll ask questions that I don't know the answer to, and I have absolutely no clue what the answer is. Or it might be answerless. And I'm having complete expectations to getting answers from opposite sides of what the answer could be. And you often hear, I don't know if this is what you want to hear. It's not what I want to hear. I just want to hear what you have to say. And being able to hear so many different conflicting opinions is gorgeous. You know, that's the value of the question mark, is being able to pry into somebody's mind, to be able to see into their world. And if you always say sentences that end with punctuation marks of periods and commas, and you never take a breath to let somebody else talk, that's not real communication. Communication starts with listening, without response, and the ability to listen fully and try to get as close to that message as possible. I often don't feel that I can get a message across completely. And the catch-22 is that I'm not sure if I could ever understand what you have to say completely. I might get damn close, and I'm going to try to get as close to 99.9% as possible, but I'm not sure if I'm ever getting a complete message across. And for a while, that scared me, and it made me not want to talk. And obviously, I broke out of that because now I'm recording, and I'm trying to talk to as many people as possible. But knowing that I could never get a full message across, at least that I believed in, that saddened me greatly. But that's part of the game, is being able to get skill and to practice wordplay and to learn how to do our best to transmit a message as well, and to be able to pick up a message that doesn't require talking. That requires open ears and a closed mouth, which goes back to the wise man from Hovamal. The wise man has open ears, open eyes, and is listening to see who his or her friends are. And I think it's very valuable. Let's do the first verse from the Tao Te Ching. And this is from a John Wu translation. I have a little pocketbook. And I'm just going to do the first verse. Tao can be talked about, but not the eternal Tao. Names can be named, but not the eternal name. As the origin of heaven and earth, it is nameless. As the mother of all things, it is the nameable. So as ever hidden, we should look at its inner essence. As always manifest, we should look at its outer aspects. These two flow from the same source, though differently named. And both are called mysteries. The mystery of mysteries is the door of all essence. Do one more. Verse 2. When all the world recognizes beauty as the beauty, then it is in itself in ugliness. When all the world recognizes good as good, this in itself is evil. Indeed, the hidden and the manifest give birth to each other. Difficult and easy complement each other. Long and short exhibit each other. High and low set measure to each other. Voice and sound harmonize each other. Back and front follow each other. Therefore, the sage manages his affairs without ado and spreads his teachings without talking. He denies nothing to the teeming things. He rears them, but he lays no claim to them. He does his work, but sets no store by them. He accomplishes his task, but he does not dwell upon it. And yet it is just because he does not dwell on it that nobody can ever take it away from him. Powerful. So in the first verse, the Tao that can be talked about is not the Tao that can be spoken. The Tao is this hidden element. You know, like, a lot of people try to talk about what they think their God looks like, and you can't describe the Tao. Tao is the present form of change. Tao and karma seem to have some sort of connections for me, whereas karma is action and the effects of action and, like, the implications of action. If you do something shitty, shittiness is going to be put upon you. Whereas in Tao is the ever-present form of change, and things get hot. But when things reach the epitome of something, they must revert back. So when things get too hot, they must cool down, because you can't get too hot forever. There's not any infinity of systems where things, you know, even light supposedly has light speed, where there's a limit on how fast things can go. Maybe. We don't know for sure, because we've never traveled that fast. And the Tao is the mother of all things, because change, this ever-present force of action, of breathing, of entropy, this change is what births life. Our death forms nutrients. Things eat that. Things grow out of our old body parts, our old nutrients. What we breathe out, even the oxygen we breathe out, might be transmutified into something else. So the change and the way that things revert back and forth all the time is, in fact, the mother of life and the mother of all things. And that's nameable, at least. Long and short exhibit each other. High and low set measure to each other. Voice and sound harmonize each other. Back and front follow each other. The back and the front. When you're facing forward, behind you is always following you. You can never turn your eyes around and look to where you've been. That's kind of this idea of the extremes, the up and down, the duality of the Tao. You know, and there's a lot of things that aren't dual, but I think it's possible to take a dual approach and a non-dual approach and to meld them together into your own ideas of what you believe can make some sense for yourself. Practice. Read. Take two things that are in conflict with each other. Meld them together. Make an idea. We can do things with our words and inside our mind without speaking, just like we can build with Lego bricks. You can smush things together that seem conflicting. You can hold two things that don't make sense together. You can put fire and water together and make ideas boil. You have an immense ability to create yourself and to create your perspective. And you can start any day, any second, any minute to create your own perspective. And I hope that you have a wonderful time doing it. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.